Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI. Hello and welcome. Today we're diving into, well, a really fascinating and frankly challenging mind, Thomas Pynchon. And specifically, we're looking at his novel, The Crying of Lot 49.
Ah, Pynchon. Yeah, a major figure, but famously elusive.
Exactly. A giant of postmodernism known for, really messing with narrative structure, digging into these big themes like entropy, paranoia.
Definitely. And Lot 49, published back in 66, sort of in the thick of the 60s counterculture.
Right. It's often called his most, maybe, accessible book. A good way into his world, which can be pretty dense otherwise.
It's a perfect gateway, I'd say. Still Pynchon, but yeah, manageable.
So our mission today really is to plunge into this world he creates, full of paranoia, these hints of secret postal systems, this whole search for meaning. It's the kind of book that leaves you questioning, well, pretty much everything.
And right at the center of it all is Oedipa Maas. Even her name gives you a clue, doesn't it? Oedipus. Maas.
Hints of riddles and maybe something more.
Exactly. She starts off as, a seemingly typical suburban housewife. Kinneret among the pines, the name itself is kind of ironic.
A bit sterile.
Very. Leading this life of, let's say, quiet dissatisfaction. But then, boom. Her world just gets turned upside down.
Because of Pearson Variety.
Her ex-boyfriend, yeah. This eccentric, super wealthy real estate guy. He dies, and out of the blue, he names Oedipa co-executor of his massive estate.
Which sounds like just a legal thing, but it becomes so much more.
Oh, absolutely. It forces her to travel to San Narciso, California. And Pynchon uses this place. It's not just a setting. It's this landscape of freeways, corporate buildings. It's like a symbol of her leaving her old reality behind.
And a critique, too, of modern America.
Definitely. He paints it as this sort of sterile, maybe narcissistic soul of the country at that time.
So this legal duty, it's really the catalyst. It starts simple, just handling an estate, but it spirals, right, into something much bigger and, well, destabilizing.
Completely. Because Oedipa starts finding these weird clues, like a strange symbol, mentions in an old play, whispers from people on the fringes.
All pointing towards this idea of a secret underground postal system.
Exactly.
Right.
Called the Tristero, or sometimes Christero. It seems centuries old.
And this throws up the huge question, the one that drives the whole book.
Yeah.
Is this Tristero thing real?
Mm-hmm.
Like a genuine hidden conspiracy, a network for outsiders.
Or is it just an incredibly elaborate prank set up by Inverarity before he died?
Or maybe the scariest possibility, is it all in Oedipa's head? A delusion.
Right. Is she losing her grip? And Pynchon just forces you, the reader, along with Oedipa, to live in that uncertainty. That's what this deep dive is really about, navigating that kind of dizzying space.
Let's talk about Oedipa herself. Her journey is quite something.
Oh, it's a radical transformation. She goes from being pretty passive, stuck in this empty marriage, to becoming this obsessive investigator.
The name, Oedipa, you mentioned like Oedipus, the riddle solver.
Yeah.
Destined to find a truth she might not want.
Precisely. And Maas, suggesting maybe more, or maybe the masses, the ordinary people, the dispossessed she might connect with.
It's interesting how Inverarity, even though he's dead, feels like such a huge presence in the book.
He really looms over everything, doesn't he? Like this trickster figure almost, the potential puppet master. His chaotic legacy seems to infect the whole world Oedipa finds herself in.
His influence just stretches out from beyond the grave.
Absolutely. And then you've got Metzger.
The lawyer, the co-executor.
Yeah, and a former child actor, which is significant. He kind of embodies that blurry line Pynchon loves exploring between what's real and what's just performance.
In his affair with Oedipa, it's described as brief, passionless. Another sign of that lack of real connection.
I think so. It underlines this feeling of superficiality, of people just playing roles, even in intimacy. It's a stark comment on authenticity.
And then there's Dr. Hilarious.
Oh, Dr. Hilarious. Her psychiatrist, ironically named, of course, he sort of represents the failure of the established systems, like psychoanalysis, to provide meaning.
And his own breakdown.
His own descent into paranoia and madness.
Mm.
Yeah, it's like this dark shadow hanging over Oedipa. A warning, maybe, about where her own quest could lead.
Chilling. It suggests the search itself can be corrosive.
And don't forget the paranoids.
Right, this loose collection of characters on the fringes.
Mike Fallopian, the people in Inamorati Anonymous, they're all obsessed with conspiracies. They give Oedipa clues, definitely, but they also muddy the waters.
They make you question, where does insightful investigation end and collective delusion begin?
Exactly. Is Oedipa one of them? Or is she on to something real? We're constantly asking that.
So her struggle is really, Well, it's about knowledge itself, isn't it? Epistemological, you'd say. Can she tell truth from illusion? Can she find the signal in all the noise?
That's the core of it. And by the end, she's incredibly isolated, but also maybe hyper-aware, just stuck, waiting for a revelation that might never arrive.
Pynchon doesn't just state these themes. He builds them piece by piece through Oedipa's journey. Let's trace that path. Where does it really start?
It kicks off in Chapter 1, The Inheritance. She gets the news about Inverarity, about being co-executor, and she's already feeling trapped in her life, her marriage to Mutomaz, the DJ.
So she sees this as an escape.
Yeah, a way out. So she heads to San Narciso, and that's the first step, really, into this completely unknown world, full of possibilities, maybe dangers.
And San Narciso itself is almost like a character, you said. Pynchon describes it looking like a printed circuit board.
Yeah, that image is key. It sets up this whole idea of communication systems, hidden connections, networks she has to try to figure out. The landscape itself feels coded.
Okay, so she arrives. What happens next?
Chapter 2, The Muted Post Horn. She meets Metzger, the lawyer, and there's this weird scene where they watch an old movie he starred in as a kid.
And the movie plot mirrors their situation.
Eerily so. It's one of the first moments that really blurs fiction and reality. And it's here we see the first major clue. This strange symbol, a muted post horn, on Inverarity's stamps.
That blurring of lines feels crucial from the start. It sets the tone, right? This deep uncertainty about what's real, what's performance, what's connected, absolutely prepares you for what's coming.
Mm.
Then Chapter 3, The Courier's Tragedy. This is a huge turning point.
What happens?
First, she sees that muted post horn symbol again, scrawled on a bathroom wall. Next to it is the acronym WASTE.
Okay, mysterious.
Then she goes to see this play, The Courier's Tragedy. It's a 17th century Jacobean revenge play, you know, dark, cynical, complex plots.
And the play connects to the symbol?
Directly. The plot is about a secret postal system, the Tristero, that fought against the official mail carriers back then. And guess what symbol they used?
The muted post horn.
Exactly. Oedipa is stunned. Suddenly, this modern mystery seems to have roots going back 400 years.
Wow. Okay, so it's not just Inverarity's prank anymore. The stakes just got way higher. This could be history, a real hidden history. It totally changes the game. So, Chapter 4, The Scope of the Conspiracy, she starts digging into history. She finds out about the Tristero fighting the Thurn and Taxis postal monopoly in Europe, this powerful family who basically ran the mail for centuries.
Real historical conflict.
Right. And the clues keep piling up. She meets a guy named Stanley Kotex who works at this defense contractor, Yo-Yo Dine. He confirms WASTE stands for We Await Silent Tristero's Empire.
Whoa.
And he says it's an underground mail system used by people outside the mainstream for secret communication. So the potential conspiracy just balloons outwards. It feels like this huge hidden network under society.
That idea of a hidden layer, an alternative system running beneath the official one.
Mm.
It's a classic Pynchon, that sense of paranoia, but also possibility.
Definitely. And by Chapter 5, The Night Journey, Oedipa is completely consumed by this. Her personal life starts falling apart too.
Her husband.
Mucho has a kind of breakdown after taking LSD, and Dr. Hilarious, her psychiatrist, he goes totally insane.
So she's left completely alone.
Utterly alone, adrift. Then she meets John Nefastus, this inventor guy who's built a machine based on Maxwell's demon.
Maxwell's demon. That's the thought experiment about sorting molecules, right?
Mm.
Fighting entropy.
Exactly. It's this perfect metaphor for Oedipa's quest trying to find order, information, meaning in all the chaos and noise, trying to sort the signals.
An impossible task, maybe.
Maybe. And then she has this incredible, surreal experience wandering through San Francisco at night. She sees the muted post-horn symbol everywhere.
Everywhere? Like how?
On trash cans, lapel pins, kids' drawings. It seems to be the mark of the marginalized, the silent, the people left out of official America.
That sounds like a moment of connection, but also deep isolation.
Profoundly so. She feels this empathy, this link to this hidden world, but it also highlights how utterly alone she is within it. It's haunting, the cost of seeing these things.
So where does it all lead? The final chapter.
Chapter 6, The Crying. All the threads seem to converge on an auction. Lot 49 in the auction is a set of Inverarity's rare stamps, and they're believed to contain Tristero forgeries.
Forgeries? Why would that matter?
Oedipa becomes convinced that someone from the Tristero has to be there. They'll need to bid on Lot 49 to buy the stamps and keep their secret safe. This auction feels like the moment everything will be revealed.
The final piece of the puzzle.
That's what she hopes. The novel ends. Well, it ends right there. In the auction room, Azudipa waits for the auctioneer to start the bidding for the crying of Lot 49.
That's fit. He just leaves us hanging.
He does, suspended, waiting. It's brilliant in a way, but also incredibly frustrating. You're left with Adipa in that state of absolute uncertainty. No answers given.
It forces you, the reader, to grapple with it all yourself. That unresolved ending is powerful. Okay, let's dig into the big ideas here, the themes Pynchon is wrestling with. Paranoia and conspiracy seem central.
Absolutely. He really probes that line. Is paranoia madness? Or is it actually a kind of heightened awareness, maybe even a necessary response to a world that feels increasingly complex and controlled by hidden forces?
In an age of information overload, maybe seeing connections, even conspiracies, is the only way to feel like you have some kind of map.
Pynchon suggests it might be. Or it might be total delusion. He leaves that open, which ties right into entropy and information.
Explain entropy here again, briefly.
It's the scientific concept from thermodynamics that systems naturally tend towards decay, disorder, chaos. Pynchon uses it as this huge metaphor. Adipa's whole quest is like trying to fight entropy, negative entropy, finding meaningful information, a message within all the random noise of the universe, of modern life.
That's a really powerful idea. And it connects to the search for meaning in a postmodern world, doesn't it? When the old sources of meaning, religion, maybe even science, seem shaky or absurd.
What do you latch onto? Adipa's hunt for the Tristero becomes almost like a secular quest, a pilgrimage. She's searching for something transcendent, even if it's hidden in postal codes and obscure history.
It shows that deep human need for meaning doesn't just vanish, even if the old systems fail.
Right. But finding meaning is tough when communication itself seems broken. That's another key theme. Pynchon sets up this contrast, the official U.S. mail representing control. Conformity.
Versus the Tristero, this underground alternative for the alienated, the silenced.
Exactly. It's a critique of how modern communication, despite all its technology, can actually isolate people instead of connecting them genuinely.
Which brings us back to that core Pynchon experience, ambiguity and uncertainty. His refusal to give clear answers. It feels deliberate.
Oh, totally deliberate. The point isn't really to solve the Tristero mystery, it's to experience the vertigo, the dizziness of the search itself. Maybe the ultimate truth is that there is no final truth to find.
That's unsettling, but maybe realistic.
And beyond those big ones, he's also taking aim at consumer culture and authenticity. That 1960s California setting isn't accidental. He skewers the spiritual emptiness he sees in consumerism.
You see that in Mucho's Dread, maybe. And Inverarity is the ultimate symbol of capital.
Absolutely. And there's a feminist undercurrent, too, in gender and identity. Oedipa's journey is partly about her defining herself outside those traditional housewife roles, finding her own purpose separate from the men in her life.
And finally, history and memory. The past isn't dead, is it?
Not at all. The idea that this centuries-old Tristero could still be active, shaping the present in hidden ways, that's powerful. Even Dr. Hilarious, with his suppressed wartime trauma, embodies how history lingers.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly and talk about how Pynchon achieves all this. His narrative style is so distinctive, the third-person limited perspective.
Yes, yeah, sticking so close to Oedipa's consciousness, it means we feel her confusion, her paranoia, right along with her. It's not objective, it's a shared experience. You, the reader, are right there in the maze with her.
And the structure, it looks like a detective novel on the surface.
But it's a brilliant parody of one. It sets up all the tropes, the investigator, the clues, the building mystery, and then completely subverts your expectation of a neat resolution. It denies that satisfaction.
That's crucial. Let's talk symbolism. The muted post horn is obviously huge.
It's the central symbol, yeah. I mean, so many things. Secrecy, rebellion, maybe a hidden connection for outcasts, maybe just noise.
And San Narciso, the city.
It works allegorically, representing that inward-looking, self-obsessed aspect of American culture.
Pynchon saw narcissism right in the name.
And Maxwell's demon.
That's a fantastic symbol for Oedipa's impossible task, trying to sort information from noise, create order out of the chaos swirling around her.
Pynchon's language is something else, too, that mix.
It's dazzling, isn't it? High and low culture smashed together. Academic jargon, science talk, 60s slang, then suddenly these passages of incredible lyrical beauty.
And the tone shifts constantly. Slapstick one minute, existential dread the next.
Perfectly captures the weirdness and the tragedy of it all. He also leans heavily on metaphors from science, thermodynamics, information theory. Entropy is the big one, that breakdown of meaning.
And the irony just drips off the page. Situational, dramatic. It reflects the paradoxes he sees everywhere in modern life, and the imagery, all those circuits, networks, communication systems. It creates this feeling of interconnectedness, but also the potential for total breakdown.
Let's pull out some specific quotes. They really nail these ideas.
Yeah, there are some unforgettable lines. How about this one? For there either was some Twistero beyond the appearance of the legacy America, or there was just America. And if there was just America, then it seemed the only way she could continue and manage to be at all relevant to it was as a paranoid.
Wow. That really lays out her dilemma. It's either this hidden meaning or just
America,
hollow and meaningless.
Exactly. And paranoia becomes this almost necessary way to impose meaning, to make sense of it. If the alternative is just emptiness, it captures that modern intellectual crisis.
And this one feels related, more poetic. Behind the hieroglyphic streets, there would either be a transcendent meaning or only the earth.
Right. The city itself is a code, hieroglyphics, to decipher. She's looking for something beyond the surface. And the alternative, only the earth, sounds so stark, so devoid of magic or deeper significance.
The cost of this search really comes through in. The ordered rooms of her memory, shedding their light, easy grace, were torn up violently, shaken, thrown into a heap.
That's such a visceral image of psychological breakdown. Her investigation isn't just external. It's tearing apart her own mind, her identity. It shows the danger in seeking this kind of knowledge.
And her frustration with being forced into a simple choice comes out here. She had heard all about excluded middles. They were bad shit to be avoided. And how had it ever happened here with the chances once so good for diversity?
She hates that binary real or delusion. The excluded middle is that gray area, the complexity that systems often try to eliminate. It's like she's mourning a lost possibility for nuance, for ambiguity to be okay.
This next one feels very philosophical. Shall I project a world? If not the world, a world. Let me decide on that first.
That hits the core epistemological question, right? Is she discovering reality, or is she creating it? Does she choose to believe in the Tristero to project that world because the alternative is unbearable?
And Pinjon's vision of the future, our president, really, is uncanny in this description of San Narciso. For it was now like walking among matrices of a great digital computer, the zeros and ones twinned above, hanging like balanced mobiles right and left, ahead, thick, maybe endless.
It's chillingly prescient, isn't it? Seeing the landscape as this information system, binary code.
It captures
both the awe and the terror of living in an information-saturated world, like you saw the internet coming.
Decades early. And finally, her self-reflection. What did she so desire to escape from? Such a captive maiden, having plenty of time to think, soon realizes that her tower, its height and architecture, are like her ego, only incidental.
That captive maiden image points to her initial isolation, maybe her domestic life. But the realization is key. Her personal situation, her ego, feels small compared to the huge systems, the potential conspiracies she stumbled into.
So when you finish the book, what's the feeling it leaves you with?
Yeah, it's that mix you mentioned. Intellectually stimulating, definitely. You're racing to connect the dots with Oedipa. But emotionally, it's vertigo. It's this profound, unsettling ambiguity that just sticks with you.
It makes paranoia feel almost understandable, not like an illness, but like a way of navigating a confusing world.
Exactly. The suspicion that maybe there are hidden patterns, that we are part of something bigger we don't grasp.
The novel really does act like a mirror, I think. It makes you look at your own need to find patterns, to create narratives, to make sense of chaos.
Absolutely. And reading it now in our age of, you know, endless information, conspiracy theories online, the questions Pynchon asked back in 66 feel incredibly urgent, maybe more relevant than ever.
It really changes how you think about information itself. Just having more data doesn't mean you have more knowledge or meaning. That's something you have to construct, or maybe fail to construct.
The struggle is the thing.
The story teaches us that the journey for meaning is often more transformative than any definitive answer, urging us to embrace the quest, even in uncertainty.
Its resonance today lies in its uncanny foresight into our digitally saturated, often paranoid world, where the boundaries between truth and illusion are constantly shifting.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.